I am so excited to have a friend in the studio. You were my alderman at one point in time. Helen Schiller, welcome to WGN. You've been here before. I don't know if you've been in these studios.
I was actually in a studio with Paul Lesnik.
Who?
Paul Lesnik.
I've heard of him. I don't know. His name keeps coming up on this show, and that's rather unfortunate, but it's fortunate.
Well, anyway, so I was here in an interview with him, and now I'm here with you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. The name of the book is called Daring to Struggle, Daring to Win. I don't know exactly where we begin here. I'll just kind of jump in there. I had no idea that in Uptown, which is much of the 46th Ward, it extends beyond that, but... Mm-hmm. I had no idea that at one point in time, there were fires everywhere, every day, and it had to do with landlord situations. It was mostly arson.
Yeah,
I can't imagine that occurring. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was the 70s, and actually, we were not the only community in the city that was plagued by arson. There was arson. As I recall, there were people screaming about it on the south side, on the west side, Lawndale, in Westtown, Humble Park. But it was particularly bad in Uptown. And there were...
Why?
I think a number of reasons. One, but the primary reason was that, triggered by the initial plan and then the consequent development of Truman College, which was literally built ultimately where many people had lived before. It was sort of in the heart of Uptown, right in the center of where there were over 1,000 people living. And there was a lot of resistance to it, but most of the people who were there were poor. It was that particular area was largely people who were either, from the South, from coal mine territory, or ex-coal miners largely, Appalachian whites, and a lot of people who were Native Americans. And but that particular spot is where they lived. And it was horrific the way in which, this was late 60s, very early 70s, before I got there. But the stories we heard from people about how the fire station, which is literally across the street from where where the college was built, wouldn't take half hour, an hour to respond, which, you know, I would question until later on in 1978 when we had a fire in our building, in our office building, which was next door to the fire station, and it did take them a half hour to respond.
It's astounding that could have gone on.
People told us stories about waking up in the morning with a wrecking ball literally tearing down their front steps so they couldn't get out of the house. These are two flats predominantly and three flats. It was a huge speculative series of activities that went on by people who saw different ways in which to make money off of the fact that this area was going to be developed and these buildings were going to be gone, and no one seemed to really care about the people who were living there so they could get away with it. And that happened largely through the late 60s, and it really began through the late 60s and early 70s. Probably was very similar to what the Young Lords had dubbed as urban removal in Lincoln Park. And then led to one of the tools that was used was arson. And it was arson for profit to disperse people and get rid of it or to be done with the responsibility of the buildings so that you could sell the property.
And get insurance.
You get insurance for the fire and then you'd get reimbursed for the property by the city in this case, and the state because whoever was paying for the city college. And they were they used eminent domain to take the property, but the people who owned it got reimbursed for
but
their land.
Was the fire department in on the whole deal?
I can't speak for the issues with the fire department. I can just say that overall, the institutions, the city's institutions response were not very good and were at best negligent.
And that's one thing you write about.
But I have to say that there were several groups, and I write about one of them in the book, of real estate speculators who own property, move people around, and in the story I told you about was a group of people that ended up being a 2020 story about nationally. We called it the Roberts Gang, but the story's in the book, and it talks about how in one instance there were people who were living in one building, There was a fire there. They were moved to another building, and then there was another fire, all within about a 10-day period. And it, people died. People were permanently disabled for life. It was really an untenable situation.
That's one thing that you said motivated you to do what you eventually did, and that is become an alderman. Another is describing, I think the thing that got to me most is a sign that would actually say, no Negro persons can rent, own property in this district except blocks inhabited entirely by Negroes.
Okay, that wasn't a sign. That was an ordinance. And it was passed in the 50s, long before I got there. But it was passed at the encouragement of the just formed Uptown Chicago Commission, and it was a result. There was a result of a black family had a man who had been a chauffeur to someone who lived on the 4600 block of Winthrop was given his house in that man's will, and there he was the first black person to own property on that block. And so the response was to restrict any black people from owning any property in Uptown except on that block. And it was a period of, you know, there were all sorts of covenants, and they were rampant throughout the country.
Is that why Chicago has this history of being a tale of two cities?
Well, I think the Chicago's history of a tale of two cities really comes from it's a factor of it. It comes from the very severe segregation that existed, but also the poverty that went way beyond the black community, actually extended to working people all over the city.
Still a tale of two cities that Brandon Johnson talks about?
I think
in his view, right, that it is, and that's one thing he wants to change.
Yeah, and I think that one of the aspects of a tale of two cities is that some people are able to easily navigate our institutions and our economic realities, and other people are not. And I believe that one of the things that to me was significant about this election was that Brandon Johnson brought a different view, a different vision of how to address the issues that face the city. And where I saw it was he's saying we need to include everybody and make sure that we're solving the problem from the perspective of the people who have the most serious manifestation of it. And then we can really improve the city for everyone. And then you're able to start moving towards, I think, one city instead of a tale of two cities.
Well, Lori Lightfoot said the same thing when she was running. And similar to Brandon Johnson, people didn't know Lori Lightfoot's name when she first jumped into the race. She was a bit more unknown, Brandon Johnson, a Cook County commissioner. If he was your commissioner, you might have known mm-hmm. who he was or who he is. However, not all that well known overall. Or all that experienced. You supported Brandon Johnson. Did you support Lori Lightfoot?
I did not. I stayed out of the election.
Okay, but this time around, you supported Brandon Johnson, correct? Mm-hmm. Why?
I just explained why.
Yeah.
I think the difference between the two, may I say, was that Brandon has a view that includes a comprehensive approach to addressing issues, not of public safety, just the concept, public safety, as opposed to talking about it just as crime. The approach to the schools and a real focus on neighborhood schools, all these things that are part of a stable community. And I think that that the notion of really building stable communities and starting from the ground up and solving problems from the perspective of people who are most affected kind of eluded the former alderman, the former mayor, and it just was a different experience she had. So while she knew and understood and wanted to address some of the inequities in the city, I think the vision of how to proceed to do that is very different. And I think that his vision is one that will receive resistance because change always receives resistance, and also because it is perceived to be antagonistic to current stakeholders who are prominent, who have a prominent power. But I don't think it is. And I think he's beginning to show that people are beginning to be a little open to it. But there's going to be resistance. There always is. There's always a different power struggles, et cetera. I think he's strong enough to address it. But I really appreciate that he's making himself clearer and clearer, and that he's inviting people to participate, because that is really what's critical. He can't do it on his own, and he knows it. Mm-hmm. But with support and ideas and implementation and people doing their own thing on the ground, that really, because they now feel free to do that, I think is very important.
Well, Lori Lightfoot, you never worked with. However, it's a long list of mayors that you did. I want to talk about all of those mayors and much more. Yeah, okay. I do. When we come back on WGN, it's Helen Schiller, alderman at one point in time for a long time. How many years?
24.
That's a long time. 46 Ward. The book is called Daring to Struggle, Daring to Win. Do you think that there ought to be a limit on how long an alderman can serve or a mayor?
Not really. I think that there's a value to institutional history and knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think that the real question is the value is not is the reality that you have to get elected every 4 years leads me to point to the fact that the real important thing to really encourage and increase is the participation of people, because that's what keeps an elected official accountable. Is the elections and their constituents. And so I think it's really important that more and more people are engaged in civic action, and we have less and less these days. So that's really the critical answer. And what I think also is that I say this all the time, that if you want change, or if you want, if there are things that are really important to you and you want to be able to see policy that responds to that, then you need to be part of creating a sea for the policymakers to swim in, to be able to give them the support and or the encouragement or some combination thereof to really ensure that the movement in that policymaking is going to go in the direction that you desire.
You know, we promote the guests that are going to be on the show. So I wrote it down. It's, well, it was on the WGN, probably still is, on the website and all that. I promote it in social media. And someone said, I don't know where you live, so I don't know this is true or not, but that you have a sign that remains in, you know what I'm getting at?
Yes, apparently. My granddaughter's apartment.
It's not my apartment. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's a sign in the window that doesn't think positively of the police.
Yeah.
But you're not responsible for that.
No, it's her sign. She put it up. And I, you know, I think it's ironic, you know, everyone is talking so much about the Second Amendment, but what about free speech? And I think that free speech is really very important. I'm never going to tell her she can't do something. I do think that we have to have a lot more accountability of the police than we currently have. And I think it has to be, not just, the existing, but it has to be constructive, and it has to be effective, and we've never really had that for years. And so that was when Harold Washington was first elected. It was that was really one of the primary issues. And if you look at the election since then, it's consistently been, especially from Lori Lightfoot, and in this last election, really critical. Coming off of all the coming off of the Laquan McDonald cover up during the end of Rahm's term as mayor, and I think it's a theme that goes all the way through.
Yeah, and I would also add to that the civil unrest.
Yeah,
or riots really.
Well,
that
people
occurred?
Are now responding, and they have been responding on it since the '60s, actually. So you have these waves of responses. When Harold came into office,
who you were close to, correct?
Yes, I was, yes. And the reason I ran in 1987, I had sworn off right for running again after previous late 70s run. Harold convinced me to run to be alderman to be his 26th vote, because as you might recall, or some of your readers may, there was an original, when he was first elected, there was a 29-21 city council where 29 aldermen were in opposition and tried to stop most of what he wanted to do. And then there were special elections that created new wards and new aldermen, and he ended up with a 25-25 split, and he came to me and he said, you can be my 26 vote. If I get 26 votes, I'll have 40, because there's always those people sitting on the fence. They'll come over. And I couldn't not do it, because I knew I could win, because I was very involved in so many things in the community, or I knew I had the potential to win.
Why was Harold Washington so good?
So let me finish what I'm going to say. Well, I think he's good for a lot of the same things that I said earlier about Brandon, but Harold had an incredible reach in the city, which was quite, you know, he just was. He knew so many people. He'd done so much stuff. He had so much experience that wasn't really recognized by the establishment because, after all, he was, you know, he was an African-American politician in a time.
Was Council Wars about power or was it about racism?
It was about power, but also policy. And it was, racism was used to be able to affect that dynamic.
Did you know then that Burke and Verdoliak were, sorry, I'll say it, crooks?
So Mark Salkin, who was my ex and who was a prolific writer and who was also an assistant press secretary assistant press secretary for Harold. But earlier, we had a magazine, Keep Strong Magazine, and then we had a newspaper called All Chicago City News. And Mark had done a number of articles where he did a lot of research, and he also was doing organizing mm-hmm. at the same time. And he was doing something called the Family Advantage and working on utility stuff. And he came across the fact that every time that there was any kind of a progressive proposal from the perspective of the users of utilities, especially Peoples Gas, Burke would act like he was supportive of those concerns. And then he would do something in the city council to block it and or to distort what it was, to undermine it. And then we discovered that he was also the attorney for Peoples Gas. So Mark did a whole expose on it and did a bunch of articles like that. So yes, I knew that. And Verdoliak, I mean, Verdoliak's brother, who might have been an ex-cop, but he definitely had a security company and he carried a gun, pulled it on some of my organizing friends on a number of occasions, threatening them because they were making his brother look bad. So, all yeah, right. I have to say yes.
So, one word to describe Blandick, Byrne, and Daley, each of them.
Blandick, bland, ineffective.
Byrne?
Clueless, actually. Byrne. Shooting from the hip, not really. Inconsistent and opportunistic.
And the second Mayor Daley?
A smart politician who loved the city but had a real blind spot when it came to police accountability.
Okay. More than one word about each of those in the book.
I can't help it.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Daring to struggle, daring to win. It's a fascinating read. 5 decades of resistance in Chicago's uptown community, but you really write about the entire city. Helen Schiller, it's so good to see you again.
Nice to see you. Thank you.